Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, PA, which, if you've been listening or know me, know that is near Philadelphia. And I think I might get to mention Philadelphia at least once on this podcast today. If you've listened in the past, you know, I've talked to people from all over the country, from South Florida to Alaska and many parts in between, and people who have run for office or in office, who've run for judge, mayor, council, all the way up to Congress and Senate. So I've spoken with some people who are Washington politicians, using air quotes so you can't see because it's a podcast. But today is my first actual Washington politician from Washington State. My new friend, hopefully we'll be friends, Noelle Frame. And we're going to talk about her story of getting into politics, being a tax nerd. And I think it's going to be neat because we're going to learn about, you know, if you get into office, how you can actually make a difference through policy and not just be another vote. So with that in mind, Noelle, thank you for taking time today from all the way across the country in Washington State.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So do you think, first of all, for Washington State, do you think a lot of people on my side of the country get Oregon and Washington confused?
I do think they do often, but Portlandia and Seattle, we have our distinct personalities, so hopefully they get us not too often mixed up.
Well, no one from Oregon has done my podcast yet, so I'll put Washington first.
Very good.
So we were talking a little bit. You have an interesting story about running for office, being appointed to office. But before I get into that, have you always been politically minded and gotten into politics, or did something spur you to really pay more attention and engage?
I don't know that I'd say always, but pretty early. I definitely figured out in high school kind of the role of public policy and some things that were happening in my life and in my high school, and started connecting the dots at that point. I went to college in Washington, D.C., and at some point in there, I really did connect the dots to electoral politics, and actually worked in electoral politics in some way, shape, or form for 12 years before I ran for office the first time.
And, you know, I noticed your background. You come from, you talk about fighting through poverty and really seeing the impacts of good or bad social structures and government policy. And it reminds me that for a lot of poor people, not that I don't know your whole story, feel disengaged from politics, but when you're poor and when you're a woman, all these things, your life, I think, becomes inherently political because so many of these decisions can make or break your whole entire life.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, definitely grew up poor. And I think for so many people, it's hard actually to think about politics because you're so focused on survival and meeting your basic needs. And so sometimes I really think it's a privilege to be able to truly think about and engage in politics. So I take that very seriously. I definitely understood the impact of public policy, certainly on my public education, which is really what spurred me to, frankly, first start to understand tax policy, but public policy in general. And I think as I later became a foster parent and helped to raise kids in my own family, did I really truly understand the public policy impacts on, like, the child welfare system, for instance. So lots of lived experience there that inform a lot of decisions I make today.
One of my most recent podcasts was with Allegheny County Commissioner Bethany Hallam. And in that podcast, we were talking about her trials and tribulations through the criminal justice system in Allegheny County and seeing that the county laws were insufficient. People were kind of just not acting on the county level to make a difference. And then the county does a lot of work. And you were talking about the foster system and the education system. And you got involved in state government. Did you do that because you saw that a lot of these problems were not being addressed by the state legislature?
Absolutely. I mean, I think criminal justice is a great example where, because I've grown up in a family with intergenerational trauma, a lot of mental illness and sort of all the related challenges of, you know, addiction and criminal justice involvement, you know, I could really see how systems weren't working as they had intended. And I spend a lot of time now on juvenile justice reform, and part of that is I've had both perpetrators and victims within the scope of my extended family and see, you know, the capacity for change and how, frankly, the system doesn't always allow folks to change and move on with their lives and make, you know, strong contributions to society. And so one of the things I really spend a lot of time on is really trying to understand how we can affect change through changes in public policy for the good, and for not just individuals, but the broader system. So lots happening at the state government that needs improvement.
And, you know, a lot of people who are outside of politics, you know, I was out getting petitions today for people running for office, and they're like, oh, whoever the Democrat is, I'll sign. And a lot of other people will say, whoever the Republican is, I'll sign. But you were talking about being in a primary, and it's a heavily Democratic area. Why did you think that your experience mattered more than just electing another Democrat?
Absolutely. So, yeah, so I represent a portion of the city of Seattle. In the scope of Washington state politics, it's one of the most Democratic districts out there. I was just reelected with almost 90%. And for me, these seats that are sort of that tilted that far left, the Democrats that get elected tend to stay there for a while. And so for me, I think that if you have the privilege of serving in one of these seats, if this is a leadership seat, it's not just a seat where you cast your vote. You have the privilege of likely getting to serve for quite a long time, and you can really dig in deep and focus on public policy and affect change in a really big way. And so for me, I had a very big vision that I am in the middle of executing on how to reform our entire state's tax structure. And I really led on that, particularly as it related to fully funding public education, as this is my vision, you know, here's how I approach problems. Here's my background as a community organizer, and here's how I'm going to get it done. And I think, you know, people saw that, helped me get through the general election the first time and then win the appointment a few years later. So I think it's a real privilege to have potentially 10, 20 years to work on public policy. And so you need somebody who's really going to take advantage of that, not just take their seat and cast their vote and not do anything else.
You know, I really find that answer refreshing, because I see so many people on social media, which, while great, is terrible, and they talk about how politicians should just be in there for two terms and go away, or, you know, they're all bad. And to me, and obviously to you, growing experience matters, because I imagine you see yourself, even now with a little bit of experience, being a better legislator than when you first ran. And you have a vision of what you could do with years of relationship building and hearings and testimony and producing legislation.
Absolutely. And I will just say, you know, as a woman who came, you know, from a childhood of, you know, poverty and trauma, you know, the fact that I even got into the state legislature, this is my fifth legislative session right now that I'm in the middle of. And I would say at least the first three, I was just managing my feelings of imposter syndrome.
Right.
And, you know, with imposter syndrome, feeling like I wasn't supposed to be there. I didn't fit in. I was a fake. Somehow people were going to find out that I wasn't smart enough to be there, which is a very, very common feature among women, and particularly people of color and women of color that are in politics. And I think just in like the last session in 2019 and now 2020, do I feel like I've really hit my stride? I know what I'm doing, and I'm, you know, affecting change in a way. And again, I think some of that is just, you know, anxiety. I got legislation passed in those first, you know, three sessions. But I feel like what I'm able to do now, I'm able to take bigger risks, move bigger changes in public policy, and really start to move the ball forward on big multi-year efforts.
Now, you talk about going into this process of having a vision and saying, this is what I think we can do in the next 5, 10, 20 years. And that's a positive way of looking at it. Of course, you know, from talking about women in politics, a lot of the criticism, or people will say, oh, she's ambitious, or she is, I don't know. They'll use that same vision that some man might have and turn it around in a negative way. My purpose for saying that is, when you got into office, did you feel welcome that you were able to bring that in, or did you have to kind of grow into that? You know, what was the challenge there in terms of establishing yourself?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're spot on. I mean, I've often joked that ambition is not really rewarded within the institution that is the state legislature. When I first got to the legislature, I was the youngest woman on the Democratic side when I was appointed. I was 35, so not that young, but compared to my colleagues, I was young. And I was very much perceived as a real go-getter, you know, just hustling all the time. And I think I was really perceived as a threat to a lot of people who thought I was impatient and not waiting my turn. And, you know, there was a lot of perception of like, you know, she's going to have to learn how this institution really works. And it took until I started passing legislation that people understood that I did know what I was doing, and I might have a different way of approaching it than they did, but that didn't make my approach wrong. It just made it different than theirs. Mm-hmm. And I have noticed a very big difference. And once I started passing public policy, and the specific example I'll give you is a major change in public policy around juvenile justice, I was able to pass a bill that had been held up for more than a decade. And that was my third session as a legislator. And suddenly I frankly started to feel like I finally got the respect that I deserved all along, but I had to prove myself. And I think people thought before that that ambition was just sort of blind ambition that was sort of naive. And I don't think until I actually translated that into a difficult public policy change did people start to understand that, yes, I'm ambitious, but it's for the greater good. It's not about me or my personality. And frankly, that's not true for everybody. A lot of people sadly do come in, and it is about their ego and it's about power. For me, it's about getting public policy done. And that bill I just talked about, at the end of the day, it wasn't even my bill. And I think that was very telling to people that I would spend so much time and energy passing a piece of legislation that didn't even have my name on it.
Oh, my goodness. But that's really tough. But on the other hand, you're obviously there to get it passed. And you know what you did, but that can be a big, big frustration for people seeing it from the outside as well.
Correct. Yeah. The newspaper articles don't really mention me in that piece of legislation, but I know what I did. And so do the kids whose lives are affected by it. And that's good enough for me.
Well, that's great. And, you know, a couple reasons I reached out to you in particular, and one of them was, like you said, being a tax nerd. Most people don't go into politics because of tax issues, I think. Most people, they might see it as tax unfairness because of the billionaire, like that kind of talk, or one thing or another. But that when I looked at your profile and what you're doing and trying to pass things, you're clearly using the tax code to make an impact, right?
Correct. Absolutely true. And, you know, I think so oftentimes people talk about, there's a phrase that says budgets are a reflection of our values. And what people mean by that is how we spend our money is really where our values are, right? That really tells you who we care about based on how much we, you know, who we spend our money on and how much we spend our money on them. And I would flip that on its head and saying our tax code is also a reflection of our values, because it says a lot about us, about who we ask to pay and how much we ask them to pay relative to other people and other entities. And in the state of Washington, we ask the lowest income people among us to pay 6 times more in taxes as a share of their income as compared to the wealthiest people in our state. And P.S., we literally have some of the wealthiest people in the world living in my state.
Right.
And we ask the poorest among them to pay 6 times more in taxes as a share of their income. That is, in my opinion, completely mismatched to what we say are our values as a state. And so we need to change that.
And do you think that the reason that the tax structure is that way is, I mean, it's a more Democratic leaning state than other states. Is it because it's not because of Democrats versus Republicans, but the kind of people that get elected and what they see?
You know, I think there's a lot of things that have brought us to this point, and it's a combination of public policy, court decisions, corporate influence, the influence of the wealthy, and frankly, just this sort of frontier libertarian streak that we have on the West Coast, where we think of ourselves as socially progressive, but we kind of are very independent and fiscally conservative. And I think another way to say that is, like, we love to buy things, but we don't like to pay for them. And that cognitive dissonance is just, like, not acceptable anymore. And it is our responsibilities as elected leaders of the state to help people understand that there are consequences to the decisions we make about tax policy. And the current system, if they feel like they're paying too much, the answer is they probably are if they're a middle class or low income person, but nobody until now has really painted a vision of what the other way could look like in a way that people could actually trust and engage in a dialogue, which is part of what I hope to do.
And I know, I've followed you a little bit. I see that you've traveled the country. You've talked with other legislators in the country too, right?
To a degree. I mean, I just spent some time, the Council of State Governments West was just part of their Western Legislative Academy this last year. And just have started to identify other legislators in other states on the West that work on tax policy might be interested in some of these topics moving forward. So definitely getting there, spending more time in my own state, particularly talking to small businesses and middle class and low income people so that they start to understand that there is the possibility for change.
But the best place you went to meet other elected people was when you came to Philadelphia for the DNC, right?
Of course. Yeah. Absolutely. Philadelphia was definitely the place where I made all my connections in the world on tax policy. Yes. Great town, man. I really enjoyed the DNC convention. It was a lot of fun.
Now I need to find a way to ever get to Seattle because I'd like to go. Yes. It's not that easy.
I recommend coming in June through September. That is the time of the year to come.
Okay. Well, I'll mark my calendar for some time in my life.
Very good.
It's not easy to get around with two little kids, but they'll be older eventually, I assume.
Yes.
So, but the point I make there is legislation seems complicated, but someone like you who seems to have quickly gotten into the nuts and bolts of things, for someone who's intimidated by the crafting of legislation, there's a lot of resources out there beyond even in your state. You can talk to people who are experts and say, wow, you did something in Washington. How did you make that happen? Because I don't know how to do that.
Absolutely. We have the National Conference of State Legislatures, which is a nonpartisan organization that you don't join as an individual, your actual institution joins. So the Washington State House joins as a member, and then we and our staff enjoy the benefits of that membership, including a lot of access to public policy resources. And a couple of years ago, they had NCSL is the acronym for the organization, an NCSL Fiscal Leaders Conference that they actually did in Seattle, which was quite convenient for me. And, you know, they presented us some research, and a gentleman from Montana actually presented, talking about how in Montana, and this was true for other states, that revenue is for state governments. Revenue is starting to decouple from economic activity, and that's creating real implications for the ability of state governments to pay for services. And it was a really big eye-opener for me to understand that just the way that the economy is changing, the way that technology is disrupting the workforce, you can think of examples like Uber and Lyft being disruptive to the taxi cab industry, for example, any changes in automation, so that you have fewer people necessary, you know, for certain manufacturing. Our tax structures across the country, by and large, are often based on capturing revenue based on hours worked and people and overall revenue in companies, not necessarily based on like the value of a good that's being produced. And as a consequence, as things change in the economy, our revenue sources are really decreasing. Another great example is gas tax. As we've had more electric and hybrid vehicles come into the market, less gas is being used, and so less revenue is coming in from gas tax in our state and other places. And that's a great example of we have to really start to think ahead about how our tax structures are changed by changes in economic activity. And I got that from going to this NCSL Fiscal Leaders Conference. The next year brought that guy to present to us at the State House, and hopefully having more speakers like that to illuminate what public policy changes we need to make in the future through the work that I'm now doing through this bipartisan tax structure work group in the state of Washington.
You talked about thinking ahead, and you also mentioned that at the time you were elected, you were the youngest woman ever elected to that position, which brings me to something I've been talking to a lot of people about, is getting more young people in office because they're not represented in the halls of state governments and certainly not in Washington to the level that everyone else is. I imagine that there's a lot of issues that you're working on where you're looking 20 years in the future and younger people are looking 50 years in the future, including thinking about my kids. And other people in the legislature are much older, and so their vision for the future is not as maybe as extensive. Not that it's wrong being older, but there's a value to having more younger voices actually in elected office, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're going to be around longer, and I think we have a stake in the outcome in a way that people that are not going to be here in 50 years are going to have. And I think if I've seen that in anything in terms of public policy priorities, is in public policy combating climate change.
Right.
The younger people that I'm seeing come into the legislature, and I should say I wasn't the youngest ever elected, but the youngest serving at the time I was elected. And thankfully, we've had even more women younger than I am serving today, which is a fantastic improvement. And there's no question about the need to make changes to affect climate change. And, you know, we've always had a pretty environmental streak in the state of Washington, and we're very lucky to have really a lot of just grandmothers and grandfathers of the environmental movement in the state of Washington. But in terms of current public policymakers, I do see some of our youngest legislators, and one of our youngest chairs in the legislature is the chair of the Environment Committee, really seeing a strong, you know, unwavering focus on combating climate change coming from our younger legislators.
Yeah, I mean, we look at what the impacts of climate change will be on, or for me and my side of the state, and it's going to be significant. But then they talk about western half of the country. It could be very devastating in so many ways. And you know, I talked to someone from Alaska, and they're already experiencing climate change in ways that no one else in the country is, and no one else can see because it seems so remote. And so I imagine that climate issues on a state level can have a much different conversation than in Washington, D.C.
It's absolutely true. And I mean, I think everybody should be as concerned as we are. But I mean, we have coastal communities that are already seeing erosion of their shoreline in a way that is causing them to think about, you know, we need to build a new school, or we need to build this new government building. And maybe we shouldn't be building it here because we're already seeing erosion of our coastline. And give it another 15 years, this building should last 30, 40, 50 years. We're not sure the ground underneath it's still going to be there in 30, 40, 50 years. And so there's real conversations about, you know, communities really up and moving further inland because of those changes. You know, I would think that states like Florida and other, you know, northeastern cities, especially after some of the hurricane and activity, would see that too in the superstorms, but maybe not. But for us, we're definitely seeing real effects and taking it very, very seriously. And I think for us, some of our wildlife are real indicators. I think one of our biggest indicators in the state of Washington is our orca population. We have these beautiful, iconic orcas, or killer whales, as they're often known, and they rely on salmon, and our salmon population is down, and our salmon population is down because of pollution and other factors changing the climate. And for us, that is the canary in the coal mine. When we see that our orcas are starving because they don't have access to salmon, and the salmon are not reproducing at the rate they used to because of climate effects, we know we have to do something, because if it's affecting the orcas now, we're next.
Yeah, you know, I think that people look at these issues, especially climate change and healthcare and some other things, and see this as a national issue, which it is. They're global issues even. But sometimes you don't realize the local and state effects. We're working on development in my little borough, and the developer said, you know, 5 years ago we would be looking at 100-year flood plans for this flood location, but now those 100-year floods happen every 5 years or less. And so we have to think more broadly about flood control for a new development. And I think it would make us all better citizens to be thinking more locally.
Absolutely true. The flooding that we have experienced in some parts of my county just in this last week alone are very telling that we have big changes that are happening.
So I have a couple of things I definitely want to ask you, but before, you know, I respect your time, but one of the big reasons I did reach out to you is your pinned tweet is about A.D. Barkin, who's one of my heroes because I'm involved in the ALS activism, been following him and all of his work. And so what about his work in healthcare are you really focused on in Washington that maybe other state legislators should pay attention to?
Yeah, so A.D. Barkin and I first got to know each other in his role at the Center for Popular Democracy, and I was working at an organization called Progressive Majority. And so we were both doing sort of the systems work to help and support progressive elected officials. And this was before I myself was an elected official. And it's just, have always admired his work in that capacity. And then with his diagnosis, his ALS diagnosis, and seeing him really just spending every last breath he has fighting for universal health care and Medicare for all, however you want to say it, I admire him so much. There really aren't words to capture how much I admire and respect him, and how out front he is being, and he's confronting people, including our Democratic presidential candidates, which I think is so critical. We have to call out people on our own party who are dismissing access to health care. I think getting to Medicare for all, getting to universal health care, is one of the most critical issues for everyone, including my generation. And I will say in Washington State, you know, we added a public option last year. We added what we're calling Cascade Care, and that is now just getting underway. But at the same time, we also, and similar, it's very similar to my tax structure work group, where we understood that we needed to have a vision and a multi-year effort and a very big stakeholder process. We started a process to say, we're going to figure out how to create a pathway to universal health care in Washington. We're going to start costing this out. We're going to start doing economic modeling to figure out what are the different ways that we could create a universal health care system in the state of Washington. We have things like Apple Health for kids, which really is leveraging Medicaid to provide access to low-income children and families. How could we scale that to have it so that all Washingtonians could have access to health care? And that was legislation that I co-sponsored last year. The bill itself didn't pass, but as often happens, we were able to create the same effect by putting it into our state budget. And so that work to create that pathway to universal health care is underway in the state of Washington, and we're trying to take a really thoughtful, measured approach and actually do the hard work of digging in and doing the math and figuring out how we're going to pay for this. The state of Washington has taken some really big steps in recent years toward building that sort of social safety net around the issues of healthcare. I mentioned the public option. We also passed the Long-Term Care Trust Act because we realized so many people are living longer and they have no savings whatsoever related to long-term care. We did that last year. In 2017, we passed paid family leave with the most progressive paid family leave policy in the nation. So I think Washington State has got a strong track record of addressing key major issues that are sort of related to healthcare, that we can get there in universal healthcare, and we're taking steps towards doing that. And that's so much of what AD's working on and what I appreciate about him so much, and happy to do my part here in the state of Washington.
I had the privilege of meeting him only once when he was in Philadelphia doing his tour in 2018. And stories like that make me feel like, all right, I don't want to go door knocking today, but I have to because someone else is doing a much harder job.
Can you just watching him, and anybody who's listening to this podcast, look him up, read his book, learn what he's about. He is at this point lost his ability to speak. He's in a wheelchair. And he and his wife and their two kids, I mean, they're just putting everything on the line out there, making sure that as we go through this process of having a presidential election, that our Democrats are prioritizing Medicare for all moving forward.
But the way you answered that question really fits in the way you've answered everything about your policy structure and your approach to government, because you said getting to Medicare for all and all of the steps you've taken in Washington State on this and other issues. So maybe the way we need to be thinking is not just about we just need to get through this next election and win this thing and hopefully we pass that bill that does that thing, but look at the states, look where things have been successful, and see how we can make the building process work.
The states are the laboratory for public policy for the federal government. And Washington State, again, we were one of the first states to raise the minimum wage. We were one of the first states to approve marriage equality through a vote of the public. I mean, we have always thought of ourselves as a leader on public policy, as a lab for progressive public policy. And I think we're going to fix our tax structure. I think we're going to get to Medicare for all. But we know that it takes digging into the details, it takes hard work, and it takes building involvement of the public. and key stakeholders to get to the outcomes that you want so that they're sustainable and lasting. And we've got a long track record of doing that. And again, I'm just trying to do my part to keep that going.
So the podcast is called You Should Run. You might feel the same way. I don't know, but a lot of people sometimes feel a lack of hope with how things are going, with the state of the world. But why do you think more people should run? Why are you encouraged? Why are you hopeful for the next round of people to get involved?
So I'll tell you, I had this conversation with my best friend in the entire world a couple days ago, that there's a lot of really terrible stuff happening in the world right now. And it's not hard to really slip into a spiral of despair. But I will tell you, I don't slip into that spiral of despair because I know I'm doing something about it. I have every single day, I have some step, something I'm doing that makes me feel like I am pushing back against despair, that I'm inspiring hope, that I'm making change even in small ways. It's really cathartic, you know. Yeah. If you are somebody, and I suffer from depression, I take antidepressants every day, and I think, you know, I could really spiral very quickly, but I give myself something to do every day. And if you are in that place where you want to see change, but you're feeling really down, I can't tell you, running for office definitely keeps you busy, and there's nothing like knocking on doors every day and talking to voters who are so thrilled that somebody would actually take the time to come to their doorstep and ask them what they think and what they need from their representatives in their state capitol or in Congress. And I don't get down that often anymore because I have something I'm doing every day to make change. So I can't stress enough how important it is for people to step up, and it's a great way to not get lost in the despair that exists in the world today.
And for me and for you, sometimes those little details that no one's going to notice or even get your name on, as you said, can sometimes be the most rewarding thing. 10 years from now, no one will realize that you did something, but you can always sit back and say, you know what, I was part of this project and my name's going to be forgotten, but I know I did it.
I see a photograph of young men who are currently incarcerated with a picture with the governor that they took last year and a different picture the year before at a bill getting signed. And it was, again, neither one of them were bills that I was the prime sponsor of, but I did a lot of work behind the scenes. Every time I see that photograph of those young men, some of which are still going to be locked up for another 10 years, but they are making change, and I did my small piece to help them make change. And every time I see that photograph, it brings a smile to my face.
Well, now that is a great place to end this. That's a fantastic way. Hopefully people will feel hopeful. If you're listening, hopefully you'll be inspired to run for office. Please follow Noelle on Twitter. It's at Noelle Frame, at NOELFRAME. She is the kind of quote-unquote Washington politician from Washington State. I think we need more of in every state. And if you can, review and share the podcast, listen to past episodes. There's a lot of encouragement out there. Thank you, Noelle, so much for sharing your story and getting other people involved.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.